From the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Monday, March 30th, 2015. A look at Nigeria's elections, the closest in 16 years that has taken place amidst growing violence from the Boko Haram group. We'll speak with award-winning journalist Tom Burgess. And Dean Obidala joins us to analyze Western hypocrisy over the framing of terrorism. Why, when white men hijack planes or attack airports, it's not seen as terrorism. Plus, Pakistani columnist and author Fatima Bhutto will speak to us live from Karachi to discuss her new novel, The Shadow of the Crescent Moon. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Rahul Mahajan, sociologist and author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. Hi, Rahul.
Hi, Sonali.
With hours left before a deadline to sign an interim agreement, U.S. and Iranian negotiators continued talks in Lausanne, Switzerland over the weekend and through today. Representatives from Britain, France, Russia and China have also been involved in the so-called P5+1 talks. A major sticking point seems to be how to dispose of Iran's current stockpile of uranium. While there have been reports that Iran might agree to transport its uranium to Russia, Iranian officials vehemently maintain they would not agree to such a move. Discussions also center on how much nuclear technology research Iran can conduct and how fast international sanctions can be lifted. The deadline for a framework agreement is tomorrow, with final talks scheduled for June. Newly re-elected Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has vociferously criticized the talks, labeled them the Iran-Lausanne-Yemen axis. Rahul, this is the closest the UN and Iran, US and Iran have come to an agreement in over a decade. Do you think that there might be success?
Well, it's always hard to guess, but in this case, I'm going to guess probably not. The United States is already lowballing the possibility of success, which is never a good sign for a party to the talks. And I think also, Iran is still going to have to figure out how to react to what seems like the sudden potential emergence of some kind of Arab military unity directed against what are widely seen as Iranian proxies in the region. And so a sort of single-minded focus of the United States on stripping Iran of any kind of nuclear capability, whether it's for power generation or anything else, is not going to be seen by them as a sensible sort of set of priorities. They're going to be wanting to talk more about the balance of power in the region. So my guess is no, it's things are not going to succeed.
Well, we'll see what happens in the next few days and, of course, in June. Controversy over Indiana's newly passed Religious Freedom Restoration Act mounted fiercely over the weekend, with many figures denouncing a potential legalization of anti-gay discrimination. Angie's List put on hold a planned expansion in Indianapolis. Basketball star Charles Barkley said discrimination in any form is unacceptable to me ahead of a final round of NCAA games, which are based in the state. Apple CEO Tim Cook wrote an op-ed against the law in the Washington Post. The mayors of Seattle and San Francisco announced a travel boycott of the state by their cities. There were street protests and social media protests under the hashtag Boycott Indiana. Governor Mike Pence, who signed the law last Thursday, appeared on ABC, where he defended it, saying he would not change it. He refused to give a straight answer to whether the law would allow businesses to deny services to the LGBT community. The state of Georgia, which was considering a similar law, has put their process on hold in response to the backlash against Indiana. Well, Rahul, I'm very heartened to see such pushback from all sectors of society. Do you think that the reaction to Indiana's bill can send a strong message to other states to not consider passing such bills?
Well, I mean, it certainly sent a strong message, and I think that some states where things are, you know, sort of on the fence may think twice about passing a bill. But I'm not incredibly sanguine about the long-term prospects for two reasons. One is that increasingly, you know, radical right-wing Republicans have shown that opposition simply hardens and confirms them in the course they have already set. And secondly, I think it's bothersome that almost all of the opposition to the bill has focused on the question of gay rights. Now, it's true that that's going to be, you know, sort of a primary area of focus of enforcement, and it's the reason that these bills are being passed now. But if you actually read the bill and similar bills, what there really are is a blueprint for denying the secular authority of the government, as the ultimate authority over religious individual religious considerations. So that's not going to go away. If they put in some language about civil rights, there may not be much protest about the rest of it.
And finally, a new Reuters Ipsos poll on how Americans view threats to the United States has revealed a bizarre set of priorities, particularly among Republican respondents. The poll of nearly 3,000 adults in the U.S. found that 34% of Republicans see President Barack Obama as a bigger threat to the United States than Russian President Vladimir Putin or Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Meanwhile, just under a quarter of Democrats saw the GOP as a threat, while 27% of Republicans saw the Democratic Party as a threat. Most feared internationally was the Islamic State, followed by Al-Qaeda, North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un, and Iran's religious leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. The issue that is likely to be a real threat to everyone, climate change, was not ranked very high on the list, with Democrats more likely to fear it than Republicans. Well, Rahul, clearly such polls themselves are problematic, but do you see the results of the survey as indicative of how our media leads public opinion to be so utterly skewed away from reality?
Well, you know, although it is true that American public opinion is highly divorced from reality, especially on the Republican side, I have to say there is a kernel of truth in this comparison between Obama and Putin and Assad, which is to say that, you know, at the end of the day, the United States is a very powerful country and has only minimal things to fear from outside forces, internal political powerful forces, whether the president or somebody else, can be a lot more of a threat to the American way of life than especially people like Putin or Assad, who have not even enunciated any threats to America and, in fact, should be rated rather low on a poll like that.
Well, Rahul, always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you later.
Talk to you later.
Rahul Mahajan is a sociologist and author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Nigeria's general elections, which were postponed by more than a month past their original date because of violence, took place on Saturday and were extended for a day. The chaotic voting over the weekend was marred by violence and accusations of fraud in what could be the closest presidential vote since the country's democratic transition. Incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan faces stiff competition from his closest rival, Muhammadu Buhari, a former military dictator of Nigeria. Voting continued through Sunday in some areas, and results are expected to start trickling in today, and a formal result is expected to be announced on Tuesday. The militant group Boko Haram has escalated a campaign of violence since last year, having killed more than 1,000 people, kidnapped hundreds, and resorted to strapping bombs to children. Over the election weekend, nearly 40 people were reportedly killed by Boko Haram, including one elected representative. My guest is Tom Burgess. He is an award-winning journalist and investigative correspondent for the Financial Times. He's the author of the new book, The Looting Machine: Warlords, Oligarchs, Corporations, Smugglers, and the Theft of Africa's Wealth. Welcome to Uprising, Tom.
Hi, good to be with you.
Now, how important are these elections? Nigeria is Africa's largest economy, having surpassed South Africa some years ago. This is Nigeria's most important election, where people are choosing a president, plus members of their House of Representatives and Senate. Is this a very significant election overall?
Well, I'd say two things. I'd say in one sense, yes, it's a vital moment in Nigeria's fragile young democracy. And in another sense, these elections are almost meaningless. Let me explain what I mean. On the first idea, you can just see in the reports from coming up from the streets of Lagos, from the countryside, from across Nigeria, the fervor with which people want to vote and the fervor with which they want to protect their vote after some very heavily rigged elections that we've seen since 1999, when the military gave power back to civilians. And there is a trend towards slightly better elections. There's also a very troubling trend towards of repeated post-election violence. And in that sense, it's very important what's going on there now. And there is a distinction, as you said, between the two candidates that's not simply ethnic or religious in terms of how they view Nigeria and how they view the world. In another sense, though, I lived in Nigeria for a couple of years and covered the country and covered some of its upheavals. In another sense, this election means very little, because whether Buhari wins or whether Goodluck Jonathan wins, Nigeria will go on being a petro state. Nigeria will go on being trapped by its wealth, trapped by the oil that it produces.
And I want to definitely get to that as well as the thesis of your book. But staying on the election for just a little bit, how seriously have we seen these elections, at least so far before the results have been announced, to be marred by violence? In 2011, the last election, hundreds of people were killed. This weekend, there was horrific violence, but still seemingly on a lower scale than before.
Yeah, it's too early, I think, to make that comparison, because the violence generally happens in three distinct phases. There's kind of pre-election violence, which is especially in the Niger Delta and the oil area, but also in other parts of the country where you have kind of political thugs at the behest of their political masters, taking out rivals in the kind of jockeying for position phase. Then there's election day itself, which by most standards seems to have gone pretty well. Some people are dead, but it looks like it's around 20 or maybe a few more than that, which is obviously tragic for them, but pretty good by Nigerian standards. The dangerous moment comes with the results. That's when last time we saw about 700 or 800 people killed, and that will come down to how the big ethnic and religious blocs react to whether Goodluck Jonathan, Southern Christian, retains the presidency, or whether it switches to Buhari, a northern military man.
Now, I understand there were biometric scanners that were distributed throughout the country to verify votes and voters, but election monitors found that there were many still in their packaging, which suggests they might not have been tested. Even the president himself was not recognized by the scanner when he tried to vote. How trustworthy could the results be? You know, I understand it's still early, but given these efforts, is there a way that ordinary Nigerians could trust the results?
Well, I think what we're seeing now, and what a lot of Nigerians are saying, is that what they're watching, what they're having to be even more attentive to this time, is the count itself. Previously, we've seen Nigerian elections rigged at the polling stations, basically either through voter intimidation or the ballot stuffing and techniques like this. That's much harder, it seems. We're using this biometric voting system, which involves a fingerprint. It makes things slower. As you say, Goodluck Jonathan himself had to be manually registered in the end when his fingerprint wasn't recognized. But I think the worry now, especially because the results are taking slightly longer than was initially advertised, is what is happening at the centralized collation centres in the states and with the electoral commission in Abuja. There are even diplomats now making unusually public warnings about what is going on behind in the closed door part of the process, which isn't really altered by having the biometric element of the actual voting.
Well, Tom, how disaffected do Nigerians feel with their current government? Is Goodluck Jonathan's failure to establish peace and prosperity a reason why Buhari might be gaining popularity? And this is a man who has a very a significant background in Nigeria. He's not an unknown quantity. And then there's also Goodluck Jonathan's raising a specter of Buhari turning Nigeria into an Islamic fundamentalist state, kind of playing off of these religious differences. He is Christian, Buhari is Muslim. There's a Christian South and the Muslim North. And there's this attempt continually to use religious or sectarian or ethnic divisions to create breaks and polarizations in the Nigerian public. And I'm wondering how those are playing out on the ground.
Well, I think a lot of people would describe those attempts to paint Buhari as some sort of jihadist as completely ridiculous, given his background, and be quite irresponsible, given, as we've said, the level of violence that we see dressed up in religion and ethnicity after Nigerian elections. To the extent to which Nigerians are frustrated with Goodluck Jonathan, I think, yeah, absolutely, they're deeply frustrated with their whole political class, and that's a bigger question here. The extent to which there is really a genuine choice. As you said, Buhari has run Nigeria before. He ran it in a pretty brutal way. He does have a reputation of being almost uncorruptible, as opposed to some very easily corruptible other leaders that Nigeria has known. But at the same time, as a perhaps overly strict autocratic ruler who doesn't take opposition lightly, he says that he's changed. It's now the democratic era, and he would rule accordingly. I think the real question for a lot of Nigerians, it's a very young population in Nigeria, very vibrant. The question for them is the extent to which they're being offered a choice between two members of an elite that can put aside their own ethnic and religious differences, even if they play on others, to ensure the status quo, or whether Buhari really would be a change if he does win.
And let's talk about the role of Boko Haram in this election. As I'd mentioned, they've escalated their tactics, and it's easy for the president, the incumbent, to say, I'm going to protect you from this threat. You should re-elect me. They're trying to undermine Nigeria's democracy. And yet under his rule, Boko Haram has flourished. There was a report in the New York Times about the Chadian army fighting Boko Haram on Nigerian soil and complaining about the absence of the Nigerian military in taking on this fight. It's not clear if Goodluck Jonathan is really combating Boko Haram pretty significantly. What is the role that Boko Haram is playing in all of this? Are they essentially an anti-democratic force that would like to see elections fail overall?
I think so. I think Boko Haram is effectively a death cult. I mean, you can draw links between Nigeria's kind of oil dependency, its economic collapse, its political corruption, and the rise of Boko Haram. But really, I think it offers a rallying call for disillusioned young men in an extremely poor place whose political leaders have abandoned them for many years. And it's, I think, a cynic would say that the fight back against Boko Haram has only really begun in the last few weeks with the election looming. Indeed, it was used as the pretext to delay the election when the opposition were gathering steam. You mentioned Idris Deby, the Chadian president. No Democrat himself, of course, but he's part of this regional alliance that is now fighting back. There are also South African mercenaries on the ground there. I think something that really brought it home to Nigerians was when there were the attacks on Charlie Hebdo and at the kosher supermarket in Paris in January this year. Goodluck Jonathan and his top people were very quick to get onto Twitter and announce "Je suis Charlie" like the rest of the world. But a few days previously, reports had begun to come out of a village in the Nigerian northeast called Baga, which had seemingly been basically raised by Boko Haram, and there wasn't a word from the government. Similarly, there's 200 young women who went missing from Chibok many months ago now. They appear to most Nigerians simply to have been left to their fate. And there is a broader question, and this is just the sharp end of it, I think, about the extent to which the security services in Nigeria are predators or protectors. In the fight back against Boko Haram, there have been atrocities committed, of course, by Boko Haram, but also by the military.
Well, let's turn to your book. And the issue that is rarely discussed is the framework for these elections. When we look at Nigeria's struggles with democracy, first of all, polls show that ordinary Nigerians are desperate for democracy. They want democracy, which people wouldn't, right? The subtitle of your book, I think, really says it quite clearly. Your book is called The Looting Machine. Subtitle is Warlords, Oligarchs, Corporations, Smugglers, and the Theft of Africa's Wealth. The underlying issue of Nigeria's economic resources, its oil, its mineral wealth. Is this why we see the kind of political violence and chaos that seems to have no other explanation?
I think it's a mistake always with somewhere as complicated as Nigeria to try and pick one explanation. But yes, I do argue in the book that an enormous reason, and a reason that maybe the outside world ignores too often, for Nigeria's political chaos, for the violence, for the poverty in a country with immense natural wealth, is that wealth itself. And just to give you the most basic explanation, I think the central thing of this is, remember, the famous rallying call of the American revolutionaries, no taxation without representation. You turn that round. How can you have representation? How can you have a government that represents the people if they don't tax the people, if that government is not funded by the people? In Nigeria, 70% of the government's income comes from, at the stroke of a pen, granting rights to foreign oil and gas companies to extract oil from the creeks of the Delta and under the seabed. 70% of government's income is revenues from oil and gas. About 4% comes from directly taxing the people. If the people don't fund the government, how are they supposed to call it to account? And what you see develop in Nigeria, and it goes for Africa's other petrostates, goes for places like Equatorial Guinea and Angola and the big mineral-rich countries like Congo, is you see a shadow state develop. Yes, there are central banks and education ministries and finance ministries, but they have very little real power. They're often kind of a facade in some way to the outside world. And instead you have cliques that wield real power and who do deals with very large foreign companies that are prepared to pay them enormous bribes. So you have a system where the ruling class, and I think it's demonstrated by the story I told a second ago about the way the political class in Nigeria basically ignored an enormous massacre in its northeast. The political class becomes detached from the country over which they rule, plugged into international commodity markets far more in a sense than they're held accountable at home.
Hmm. Tom, the price of oil in recent months has plunged worldwide. How has that affected Nigeria's economy in terms of the living conditions of ordinary Nigerians? And then in the long term, how that might be feeding Boko Haram?
Well, the immediate impact was on the Nigerian budget. I mean, as I just said, about 70% of the government's income is oil and gas. Mm-hmm. So the oil price halves, that's a big fall in your budget. So they've had to they're having to rein in on some government spending. There's a weird contradiction always when you think about the extent to which this hurts ordinary people. Ordinary people in Nigeria are largely outside the oil economy. They feel the lack of their ability to hold their leadership to account, and they feel these crazy paradoxes like petrol shortages, which could ease, if anything, because the oil price has fallen. In terms of Boko Haram in the north, I'm not sure that you could say the northeastern Nigerian economy is plugged into the oil price to any great extent. I think what you could see it's effectively a raising of the stakes, right? The pot in the middle has become smaller. The patronage system, which is really what holds Nigeria together, has less oil money to lubricate it. It makes it all the more urgent for people at every level of government to capture what little bit of patronage they can.
And finally, Tom, you write in your book, I started to see the thread that connects a massacre in a remote African village in Nigeria with the pleasures and comforts that we in the richer parts of the world enjoy. What is that thread? How do you make the story of what's happening in Nigeria a relevant one to the rest of the world? Because really, we really ought to consider our own comforts and pleasures as being linked back to Nigeria's mineral wealth.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think it's quite strange that we don't. I mean, we're obsessed with where our coffee comes from, but not our copper, you know, or our oil, or our iron, or our diamonds, although we've started to twig with this idea of blood diamonds. I think that the supply chains are there for all to see. I mean, until the shale boom in the US, Nigeria was the third or fourth biggest supplier of crude to the US. You fill up your tank, basically, effectively, given the size of Nigeria's supplies to the world economy, if you fill up your car with petrol, with gas, 50 times, one of those tanks is Nigerian, and that money directly contributes to the poisoning of Nigerian politics and to in part to the enormous poverty, especially in northern Nigeria and in the Niger Delta. And that pattern is the same in dozens of African states. And we seem much more concerned with keeping out the things from Africa that we don't like, people who may have caught Ebola, refugees, economic migrants, much more concerned with keeping those things out than with realizing our own role in supporting the worst bits of African rule.
Well, Tom, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll monitor the results from the elections as they become available. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
My guest is Tom Burgess. He's an award-winning journalist and a correspondent for the Financial Times. His book is called The Looting Machine: Warlords, Oligarchs, Corporations, Smugglers, and the Theft of Africa's Wealth. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. This is Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Did you know that Uprising is now a TV show as well as a radio show? We rely on subscribers to our YouTube channel to fund the TV production of Uprising, and you can sign up to be a subscriber at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. The tragic plane crash in the French Alps last week that killed 150 people is being treated with great sensitivity by authorities and the media. After all, the pilot was a troubled man with medical and psychological problems. He even had a doctor's note to call in sick but ignored it, locked his co-pilot out of the cockpit, and flew himself and more than 100 other innocent souls to their doom. But what if Andreas Lubitz had been Ahmed or Mohammed? What if his skin had been a hue other than white? We know now how the script would have unfolded and how the T word would have been expressed at the outset before any facts came to light. Of course, I'm referring to terrorist. And here in the US, the hypocrisy is just as appalling. In mid-March, a 63-year-old white man named Richard White, who is a Jehovah's Witness, attacked TSA officers at New Orleans Airport. And then 2 days later, a 67-year-old white man named Michael Sibley, based in Georgia, planted two bombs at a national park. The self-described patriot even planted a Quran with the bombs to make it look like a Muslim might have planted it. But there was so little news coverage of these two incidents that it's likely you would not have heard of them. What if the two men had been Muslim? We would have heard no end of the deadly specter of the homegrown terrorist. My guest is Dean Obidala. He is an award-winning comedian, co-director of the 2013 film The Muslims Are Coming. He writes regularly for CNN.com and The Daily Beast. Welcome to Uprising, Dean.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Now, what do you make of the news coverage of Andreas Lubitz? Have commentators humanized him? I've seen the words inner torment and depressed. I've even read that he was a gliding enthusiast and a former flight attendant, and he was unassuming and funny. And of course, we do need to see people's humanity, even that of criminals, but there seems to be a double standard.
There's no doubt there's a double standard. I don't think anybody objectively could deny there's a double standard if a Muslim commits a violent act versus a non-Muslim. If it's a Muslim, then the investigation ends with the determination of the person's faith, frankly. It becomes, well, they're a Muslim, and they did it because of Islam, and they find out why they were radicalized, who they associated with, if they went to a mosque, they implicate their friends and their neighbors or anyone else they spoke to. If it's a non-Muslim, the first presumption is there's mental illness. We see this left and right. Obviously, with the co-pilot, Andre Lubitz, if he had been Muslim, the coverage would be completely different. But that's really understood. It's really the lesser issues and the fact that the media doesn't even cover with even half the zeal attacks, violent attacks in America, which are arguably terrorism by non-Muslims. And that's why I wrote articles about both those issues you mentioned for the Daily Beast last week.
Right. So let's talk about some of them. One was this New Orleans incident, a man who attacked the TSA officers at New Orleans Airport with a machete. This sounds similar to the 2013 shooting at LAX, LA International Airport, where another man, a white man, Paul Ciancia, attacked TSA officers with a gun. In that case, fatally shot a TSA officer named Gerardo Hernandez. There seems to be a pattern here of disturbed white men attacking TSA officers and airports, but of course, I doubt we'll see any racial profiling.
Well, you won't. We know you won't. You won't see any profiling. You won't even see any kind of statements that are broadly attacking the suspects and looking at some factors they might have in common because they're not Muslim. In the case of the TSA, if people Google simply stop the TSA, you will see page after page of conservatives and libertarians demonizing TSA officials. They are a target by the right and libertarians. Not saying they're advocating violence, but they are a target. And when you know that you gin up that hate of federal officers, and Paul Cinciano was actually charged with terrorism, 3 months later, after he was arrested, he was charged formally with terrorism.
Right.
They got almost no media coverage in America, the fact that a non-Muslim was charged with terrorism. This guy, Richard White, not only had a machete, that could be a crazy person. He not only had poison spray in his bag, he had six homemade bombs in his duffel bag. And in his car, the police found oxygen tank and acetone tanks, which if you Google those two, that's the simplest way to make a massive explosive. The man was going to commit an act of terrorism. There's no doubt about it. Was it infused or inspired by mental illness, or was it inspired by some kind of anti-government hate? You know, that's the decision that law enforcement have to make. I spoke to law enforcement in Jefferson County in Louisiana. He said, we'll never know because the guy's dead. That's the laziest police work I've ever heard in my entire life, because the suspect's dead. We stopped our investigation, and I asked the spokesman for the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office, "What did you look at what websites he had gone to? Had he frequented anti-government websites? What radicalized this man?" And they gave him this boilerplate answer, like, we've investigated everything and we don't see any connection to any organizations. They didn't say he wasn't radicalized. They didn't say he didn't visit anti-government websites. They just have stopped their investigation because it's uncomfortable to go further to say that Americans, our fellow Americans, are killing us or being terrorists. But it's okay if the terrorist is a brown person from outside of the country or an American who's Muslim, because to some, American Muslims are foreigners, so they have no problem demonizing us.
And actually, I want to just clarify real quick. I did say that Richard White was a white man. He is now dead. In photographs, he appears to be African-American.
It does seem to be African-American.
But it's not
His
clear.
Race wasn't mentioned. It's not relevant to the attack. It really wasn't
He's
mentioned
He's not Muslim.
That's the only, that's really the, you know, that's the investigation. There was a shooting in Canada, in Ottawa, and the investigators, the reporters in Canada and in America were so different. They're journalists, and I wrote about it. In Canada, the attacker was Muslim, but they didn't stop there. They looked at his mental illness. They looked at the fact that he was alienated from his family. He had almost psychotic episodes. He had been homeless, living in shelters. We didn't hear any of that in the American media. The minute they found out the shooter in Ottawa was a Muslim, that ended the discussion. I feel bad for the Canadian reporters. They actually have to do work. American reporters, once you find out the person's Muslim, you can stop. It's what a great job that is. You know, so my goal in writing these articles and going on the media and begging, literally pleading with my friends in the media last week, who I know at CNN and MSNBC, to cover these stories, is to undermine the sentiment that I get all not Muslims are terrorists, but all terrorists are Muslim. That's not even factually in the ballpark, and I've written about that. But when all Americans hear is the term terrorist applied to Muslims, they're going to think that is accurate. It is not their fault when the media leads them down this incorrect path. So I blame the media. I don't blame my fellow Americans for not knowing any better when the media does nothing to help them learn the real facts.
Well, Dean, the media coverage of the 2009 mass shooting at Fort Hood in Texas by Nidal Malik Hussein and the coverage of the Boston Marathon bombings where the surviving suspect is Zokar Tsarnaev, who's in the middle of a trial now. You could argue that in both those cases, there was very likely some severe mental either illness or pressure or doubt involved, but we didn't really see much coverage of that, even if those issues might be raised by the defense lawyers in a trial setting.
Right. I mean, especially with the Fort Hood shooter, if I recall correctly, had a history of mental illnesses, yeah. Even though himself was a doctor. But he had sought treatment, was wrestling with many issues. Mental illness played a big role in that. To what extent, we don't know because it's not really investigated by our media. With the Tsarnaev brothers, it's likely there's mental illness. I don't see a history of them being treated. I haven't seen that in the media. Yeah. But with Fort Hood, yes, with Major Hassan, there definitely was. But again, it's almost like if you're a Muslim, you can't be mentally ill. Everything we do is strategic and planned and it's dastardly. But if you're, you know, I have mental illnesses just like everyone else. People in our community have mental problems just like anybody else does. And that can be the reason they commit some attack. You know, there's the fact that they view some religious war in their mind going on, perhaps. But that's also a symptom of a mental illness. But I'm not saying ISIS are mentally ill. I think they're calculating people who commit horrific acts in the name of their own faith, which really isn't Islam. It's the name of their own faith, which is power and greed and vanity and ego. That's what their religion is about.
And so, Dean, the incident in Georgia a few days, also in March, which seems to underscore how some people are banking on Americans seeing Muslims as terrorists, is interesting as well. This man essentially planted or tried to plant a couple of bombs at a national park alongside a Quran. And this guy is someone who calls himself a, quote, patriot. Can you tell us a little bit more about this and what it represents?
Sure. Michael Sibley was arrested in Arraigned last week in federal court in Georgia. I'm sure most people haven't heard about it because the mainstream media conveniently ignored it. And I wrote about it and begged people. And MSNBC, one show, did mention it, and at least they mentioned it. He planted a bomb in a national park, two improvised explosive devices, according to the complaint in federal court that he created by reading about him on the internet. In this knapsack with the bombs, he put a Quran. He put a book called The Rape of Kuwait, which has a picture of a Kuwaiti flag. It looks very Middle Eastern. He wrote the name of the backpack owner being a Muslim name, which it's a very simple name. If you Google it, there's many Muslims with that name. I have no doubt he picked that intentionally. He also included a local map with the circle around the Jewish Community Center and a few other soft target places, things that he thought Muslim extremists would target. Put that bomb in the national park there, and Luckily, it didn't go off. But the law enforcement came after they found it and detonated it. It was a real bomb. There's no doubt it was a bomb. It exploded when they detonated it to keep it safe from anyone else getting near it. So he wasn't even charged with terrorism. He was charged with attempted destruction of federal property. If anyone was injured or killed, perhaps he would have been charged with terrorism or just charged with mental illness. I'm not sure. The one thing I will say, no one in the media has raised mental illness. This guy clearly wanted to inspire anti-Muslim bigotry. He said he was a patriot to the FBI, wanted to wake up the world to the threat of what's going on around the world, which is really Muslims. And waking up Americans to the threat of Islam is something I see on anti-Muslim websites all the time. That's really one of their normal talking points. To me, this guy was no doubt radicalized by these anti-Muslim websites, radicalized by the likes of Pamela Geller, Robert Spencer, and even right-wing politicians. Again, I spoke to the U.S. Attorney's Office in this case. They wouldn't comment. They wouldn't tell me what he was radicalized on. But their defense is that it's going to trial and this stuff will all come out to the public if he doesn't enter a plea. And if he does enter a plea, then they'll release the information. So as a former lawyer, I can understand that with the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Right. You mentioned Pamela Geller, the rabid Islamophobe. Ayaan Hirsi Ali also has a new book out. So it'll be interesting to see how people take that up.
In the old days, people put white hoods on when they were going to demonize. Now they can go on television and sell books and make profits off hate. They should hold up signs, "We'll hate for food." They really are some of the worst people out there.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Dean Obidallah, for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
And we'll post links to your articles in the Daily Beast about some of these issues later today. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
My guest, Dean Obidallah, is an award-winning comedian, co-director of the 2013 film The Muslims Are Coming. He writes regularly for CNN.com and the Daily Beast. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. The Northwest Frontier Province is a name that began being bandied about in the Western media after the September 11th attacks. It is a mysterious region in the rugged mountainous border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, where tribal communities rule themselves and into which extremist groups like Al-Qaeda and the Taliban move in and out, taking advantage of favorable social and political conditions. It's an area that the U.S. has repeatedly bombed with drones and that the Pakistani army has also laid siege to. It's also an area that provides a troubled backdrop to a new novel by Fatima Bhutto, the talented journalist and author whose earlier book is Songs of Blood and Sword. Bhutto is also a poet and a political columnist. She happens to be the niece of the assassinated former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto and the granddaughter of former Prime Minister Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. Her new book is called The Shadow of the Crescent Moon, a novel about three brothers living in the town of Mir Ali in Waziristan, northwest Pakistan, who have differing aspirations for their future. The Financial Times called it, quote, a human story with love as well as ideology. I'm very pleased to welcome Fatima Bhutto to Uprising live from Karachi. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, we had you on our show in 2010 about your earlier book, Songs of Blood and Sword. So it's great to have you back on with your new book. And I very much enjoyed reading your book. In the U.S., people don't really have much context for what life in a place like Mir Ali is like. And also, it's very much unknown here in the United States, even though our tax dollars have bombed the areas around that. Is your book an attempt to humanize a place that really ought to occupy some commentary and some time in particularly the U.S. consciousness?
Yes, that's right. It's not just the U.S. It's all over the world. Whenever you look at Pakistan, you only see it as a news story, as a headline. And that headline is terrifying and violent. But we always seem to miss the people, the ordinary men and women behind those stories, and especially the women. So Shadow of the Crescent Moon was important for me to do because I wanted to talk about what it's like for young people, what it's like for young women and young men in their 20s and their 30s in a place like Pakistan, and actually how so much more connects them to the world than disconnects them.
Well, Fatima, why has Mir Ali had the kind of history and politics that has thrust it into the midst of war? Is this just a matter of geography?
Well, one could say the same about Pakistan itself. You know, Pakistan's in an incredible position. It shares borders with Afghanistan, with Iran, with India. And we are in a very strategically, well, fortuitous or unfortunate position, depending on how you look at it. Mir Ali is in the tribal regions, as you mentioned, near the border with Afghanistan. So, of course, it's become the center of the drone war, of the war on terror, of Pakistan's military strikes, and a part of the country that was always, you know, semi-autonomous, that always viewed itself very independently, suddenly felt the weight of the world upon it.
And why did that happen? Explain what the sentiments inside a place like Mir Ali have been. Of course, it's not homogeneous, and that's why the three main characters in your book have differing aspirations. But in general, there has been an insurgency in Mir Ali that has pitted it against not just the Pakistani army, but the United States.
Yes, and you see this again throughout the country, but in the tribal regions, you have people who have a very fierce loyalty to their ethnicity, to their language, to their history, and to be not just pushed into the Pakistani mainstream is a problem, but then to be pushed into this humongous narrative of the war on terror is another problem. Because of its proximity to Afghanistan, because we have politely put, a porous border, a lot of the attention is focused on the tribal regions. But there are families there, there are children there. And we've seen also, as the drone wars and their amazing illegality really gets discussed more and more, we have accounts from children saying, we're afraid to sleep at night because we can't hear the drones until they bomb us. So we live what we imagine is an ordinary day until suddenly it's over. Mm-hmm.
Now, the oldest of the three brothers, who are your sort of three protagonists in your book, Aman Iram, he just wants to get out of there. He wants to escape and joins the many would-be migrants from Pakistan who want to find a better life by emigrating to the West. How typical is his story?
Yeah. It's pretty typical, actually. Aman Iram is an intelligent, ambitious young person who is tired of having a border put around him. He's tired of not getting the jobs he wants. He's tired of not being connected by a good internet. He wants things. And he's no longer going to let his country or his nationality stop him from that. And in a way, it's very common because we have a lot of young Pakistanis migrating abroad, as you said. But understandably, more and more, because how do you convince someone to stay in a country where even survival is questionable?
Then there's the second brother, Sikandar, who's a doctor working in terribly poor conditions inside Mir Ali, one of the main characters in your book, struggling with a wife who has suddenly developed mental illness. He's just trying to keep his head above water. Who does he represent?
Well, I think when you live in a dangerous country or in a dangerous environment like Pakistan, there's no question of being afraid. There's no time to be afraid. You have to survive. You have to keep going. But of course, it's frightening. And it does become an ordinary way of life to get used to things like terrorist threats, like bombings, like shootings. But Sikandar I identified with and understood because, of course, it's not normal. Of course, it invades your dreams, it invades your waking hours, and it distorts how you see the world.
And then there's the youngest brother, Hayat, an ideologue who's moved by the oppression that he sees around him of his, you know, fellow residents and wants to fight for their freedom. One might imagine that he might represent the most sort of stereotyped of people in Mir Ali. But through reading your book, of course, there's complexity that we don't get through our media reports here. Tell us a little bit about this character, Hayat.
Well, Pakistan has become a country of sacrifices, and it demands a sacrifice from everyone now. It's no longer an option. So the question is, what will you sacrifice? Will you sacrifice your freedom or your comfort? Will you sacrifice a loyalty or a fidelity to an idea or a cause or a people? What do you give up? Because this is a country now that where blood demands blood, where violence is met by more violence. And I think Hayat personifies this horrible choice that's forced on its people. What do you give up in order to keep going, in order to survive, in order to make something? What are you going to be forced to hand over?
There's also a very strong female character in your book, Samara, who is a complex character herself. She, in the beginning of the book, has fallen in love with the oldest brother, and she's certainly not the caricature of the helpless Muslim woman that we get here in the West. Tell us a little bit about this character and what you infused with her, into her, rather.
Well, for me, this is a novel about women. The Shadow of the Crescent Moon, for me, is about the amazing bravery and complexity of Pakistani women. Again, if you're looking at the media, the mainstream media, you see only one kind of Pakistani woman. She's frightened, she's very small, she's neither seen nor heard, and she's really relegated to the fringes. But of course, if you come to Pakistan or India or Bangladesh or Sri Lanka or Afghanistan or any of these countries, what you'll notice is that women like that don't exist. They are at the very epicenter of the turbulence and violence that this part of the world faces. But in order to live here as a woman, you have to fight. You become you become warriors. And Samara and Mina, the other female character in the book, are the very kind of Pakistani women I've always known. They're the kind I see every day, not just in Karachi, but across the country. And they're women who, though it's easier to say no, and though it's easier to just stay quiet, don't. They fight for what it is that they believe is right, and suffer the consequences, in fact.
Now, it's interesting to look at this area in the Northwest Frontier Province from the outside, seeing it as Pakistan, but really within Pakistan, this is an area that's it's a tribal region. There's a semi-autonomous rule. The Pakistani government has limited authority. It is in a very mountainous area, or it's rural. But what about the urban centers of Pakistan, such as in Karachi, where you are, or Islamabad? Are Pakistanis aware of the reality of life in places like Mir Ali? I mean, I know Pakistan has a very vibrant press, so one might imagine that there's a good amount of reporting that takes place.
Well, I mean, not really, unfortunately. I think you see the same kind of thing. Karachiites are concerned with Karachi. They're concerned with their province. People in Lahore are concerned with the Punjab. And because this is an enormous country, you know, we have almost 200 million people in Pakistan, it's difficult, really, to stay abreast of everything. But as the news and as the, you know, things like drones and the army's own attacks on the northern areas increase, people have become more and more familiar with this part of the country.
And in terms of writing this book, and I'd like to ask you about your process of putting this together. Did you spend time in Mir Ali itself to do research for your book? Are the people you met, did they give you a basis for the composites that your characters eventually became?
Well, not in Mir Ali specifically, but when I was working as a journalist many, many moons ago, I traveled a lot to the northern areas in Pakistan. And I used to have a column, and so, you know, you file 1,000 words a week. And so much got left out of that, because, of course, you can't describe every interaction and every small intimacy or moment you share with people. And those things stayed with me, and they bothered me, and they disturbed me. And when I sat down to write, those were the sort of things that came out, oddly enough.
Now, the situation in the United States with respect to how our government has carried on an illegal drone war, it's very sad that most Americans would not be able to point Waziristan in the Northwest Frontier Province on a world map. How important is it for us to humanize the people who live there? You know, on the one hand, we're just assumed that they might all be these homogeneous homogeneous jihadis who inexplicably hate the West. And obviously a book like yours, even a fiction book, can create the very necessary complexity to humanize them. How important is it for Americans to humanize them?
Oh, it's enormously important because drones, by their very design, dehumanize life. The very purpose of a drone is that you don't have to traumatize a soldier who doesn't have to put on combat gear. He doesn't have to walk on the ground and look into the faces of the people who he's fighting. You know, he sits in a very removed room somewhere in Nevada and presses buttons and works with controls, much like a video game. So the very design of drones is to separate, you know, the killer from the killed. It is to separate the violence that's being enacted. So I think it's very important to humanize them. And also to know that, you know, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, when people started talking about drones, it was only in relation to countries like Pakistan. But, you know, now it's Yemen, now it's other countries. And we're just seeing such an amazing increase in the use of drones with every month.
Yeah. And the other aspect that your book covers is how children have become such victims of so many of these forces of violence. And I think until Malala Yousafzai came around and her story became so popular in the West, people really had no idea how children are traumatized, victimized, and targeted, but not just by the Taliban, right? By the Pakistani army, by U.S. drones.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting you mentioned Malala because it was Malala's blog for the BBC that really brought that home for so many of us, because she didn't just talk about the Taliban attacking schools. She also spoke about the fear at hearing, you know, helicopters, at hearing, you know, the gunfire of your own country's army. And of course, it's propelled Malala to great heights. But there are so many Malalas in Pakistan still today. She's been very good, actually, at keeping this in people's minds. But it continues. There were even hearings a couple months ago, weren't there, in the States, where young children testified about what it's like to live under drones. And it's heartbreaking to hear.
Yeah. And Fatima, in Pakistan itself, the Pakistani army's responsibility and role in all of this, and the government's role in all of this, is also very much a part of the equation. And Pakistan has had a turbulent political history. Your own family has been very much involved in the political history. And recently, of course, people heard of the horrific attack on the school in Peshawar in December, where scores of children died. And Pakistan brought back the death penalty in response to that. And just as the U.S. tends to respond to violence with the violence, has Pakistan gone in that same direction?
Absolutely. And, you know, at present, Pakistan is the second largest death row population in the world after China. There's something close to 8,500 people on death row in this country and 1,000 who have exhausted their appeals. 44 of those are women. And what Pakistan has done in response to those horrible attacks in Peshawar last December is to reinstate the death penalty. They've executed just about almost 50. I mean, I think it was supposed to be 40 people last week, in 7 days ago. There was another 30 added to that. Almost as though, as some have said, they're trying to fill a quota. I think it's a moral catastrophe for Pakistan, because in the face of violence, to return to a knee-jerk call for vengeance and for blood, that's extremely worrying.
Finally, Fatima, are you going to follow this current novel, In the Shadow of the Crescent Moon, with another one? Are you exploring your fiction writing career over the journalist career?
Yes, very much so, actually. I don't really think of myself as a journalist anymore at all. I would love to write more fiction coming up.
Well, I want to wish you the best of luck and encourage our audience to pick up a copy of the book. It's really great. I've been enjoying reading it. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Fatima Bhutto, former journalist, poet, writer, author of a number of books, including Songs of Blood and Sword. Her latest book, which we've been discussing, is The Shadow of the Crescent Moon, a novel that is set in Mirali in the Northwest Frontier province in the border region between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Fatima Bhutto also happens to be the niece of the assassinated former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto and the granddaughter of former Prime Minister Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. This is Uprising. Bipasha Shom is our senior producer. Anna Buss is our assistant producer sitting in for Bipasha today. Christian Beck is our production coordinator. Joseph Stone is our technical director. Federico Garcia is our audio engineer. A very special thank you to Jonathan Alexander. Annie Mendoza is our social media coordinator. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you tomorrow.